Hey everyone, it's been 5 months, a little less than 5 months, but we're going to go ahead and do this Lookout Landing podcast, despite the fact that there's no baseball news to talk about whatsoever, and everybody just wants to talk about the Seahawks anyway. So, Jeff, how's it going?
It's going good. Did you see the Seahawks game on Sunday? Of course you did. I don't know why I asked that question. That was a really bad question to ask first. But we have not done this for so long that we've lost all of our conversational chemistry, so I forgot how to do this.
Yeah, actually, I was just reading about, you were asking prior to when we hit record about Robert Griffin III's injury, if they'd come out with any diagnosis yet, and it's gone back and forth on, you know, the various sources, and I guess what turns out it's complicating the issue is that RG3 had an injury in college to the same knee where he tore at least part of his ACL, and I guess they did a rehab or something. I don't know. They didn't surgically fix it all the way. So now they're like, we see a tear in his ACL again, but we don't know if that's from the old injury or the new injury, which in my mind doesn't really answer the question of, well, do they need to fix it or not, which is the important question. But just reading the sentence about it, it was funny. It was like, but it's unknown how severe it is because a previous knee injury he suffered at Baylor required two screws and, this is my favorite part, a rubber band to hold it together. And now I know, seriously, there's medical rubber bands, and that's a whole thing. But just that's hilarious, right? Just the we're not gonna fix your some screws and a rubber band.
Yeah, I mean, you just add duct tape to the sentence. And he's a joke about bad doctors,
right? Or it's Dr. MacGyver. What, you know, it's just write your own joke there. But anyways, yeah, that was a good. No, it was not a good game. That was not a fun game. I was so stressed out.
I've embraced being a bandwagon fan, which is a weird one, a weird feeling to be aware of, because I think maybe the right way to do it is to be a bandwagon fan first, and then you become a loyal fan. And I used to be like a diehard loyal Seahawks fan, and now I've slipped into bandwagoning just because football doesn't capture my interest that much anymore. So now it's this constant cycle of like self-conscious fanhood where it's like, I don't know, this doesn't feel right. Do I be a part of this? They're really exciting, but I kind of gave up on football, so I don't belong. So
I don't know. I mean, isn't it kind of, in a way, the best thing to be a bandwagon fan? Because the bandwagon fan just doesn't pay attention when the team sucks. And you know what? Being somebody who's covered the Mariners for the last 5 years, God, I wish I was a bandwagon Mariners fan.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It is the rational approach to fanhood, and that's why I can't stand when people judge other people on their fanhood, no matter what they are. But, like, there's the thing about bandwagon fans is that they're smarter than us, because they're not investing in what is a product that is not returning their investment, which is good business, good emotional business, good financial business.
Right. Although you could argue that they probably... they're obviously protecting themselves from the drudgery of, for example, the Mariners, but the Seahawks season, for example, won't feel as good to a bandwagon fan as it would be to somebody who slogged it out for, not that the Seahawks have been terrible, but,
you have a question then of a bandwagon fan, so that we're just going to do this black and white. A bandwagon fan will enjoy hypothetical Seahawks Super Bowl less than diehard Seahawks fan will. That is, I think, a given.
Right.
And so the question is, how much less will... what is the margin of that difference in enjoyment versus the disappointment avoidance of not paying so much attention to the bad season?
Yes. We need to apply graphs and numbers to what is an entirely emotional, irrational decision and investment.
It's
which,
the best kind of science because it's unfalsifiable.
Yeah. And it would probably be pretty interesting, but there's, like... I mean, even if you were conscious about it, I don't think there's a way you can change it. I mean...
if the Mariners win the World Series next year, we will all celebrate and we'll be like, it was all worth it! It was worth it the whole time! But, you know, was it?
No.
No, because we had Jose Vidro and his frosted tips. Like, that wasn't worth it. There's no... we can't... I don't think it's right to... retroactively justify our being complete idiots about the Mariners for a decade of just agony because they win four games when the other team doesn't win four games in a series. But that's how we're all going to we would all hypothetically feel. So I guess ultimately, who gives a shit?
Yeah, the way it works for me because I'm not a bandwagon Seahawks fan. I don't, at least in my opinion, I'm not. But I'm also not a diehard. I go to two-ish games every year. But I'm also not a huge, from a rational standpoint, I'm really not an NFL fan. The game is brutal, like unnecessarily horrible on people's lives, and it makes me really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, it's, and this is why it's probably, you know, it's an immensely popular sport for a reason. Like, I'm sitting here aware of the concussion research and aware of how they're damaging everybody's lives, and yet I'm sitting there just yelling my head off at the same time because football is so id. Just, you know, it's so emotional.
Yeah, I was, when I was having my little sort of meta moments watching the game on Sunday in the sports bar in Portland, just loaded with Seahawks fans. I was in there walking in. I thought, I don't belong here. Like, first of all, I'm late. Which, I mean, that's like an indication right there. Like, you are not that into this. And then, like, I don't really, you know, football is basically just watching gladiators. They were just, we're just cheering for death and
yeah,
mutilation. And I walk in, it's like, oh my God, they scored a touchdown. This is fucking incredible.
Right.
It just grips you. It's like a, if you go to a hockey game and a fight starts, then the way that you feel about the fight is completely removed from the way you feel about fighting when you're not actively watching a fight.
Yeah. Or
that is, there's no reason for that to be. And then it happens, and then it's like, well, there's every reason for that to be. And that's it.
Yeah, no, it's the two are very similar. And I guess that's the other thing, is with no hockey at all this winter, it's kind of been like, yeah, I can, I'm, for my emotional male ego lizard brain outlet sort of thing, I've had to just no other choice really but football, because the most emotional sporting related outburst I've ever had would be Felix's perfect game. Yes, but that would be probably the only baseball moment on the entire top 10 like emotional outbursts for me. Mm-hmm. Everything else would be hockey and the NFL.
Yes. I was overjoyed to find out that hockey's coming back because I missed that sort of, I guess I don't need to go over the history, but I care about hockey a lot more than football, even though I guess it's sort of a similar game, except maybe a little less extreme.
Well, it's probably just less studied. I mean, it does not. I'm not sure that the NHL is any better when it comes to like head injuries.
Well, it's not any necessarily better in terms of management or severity, but there's. I mean, you look at in football, every player gets hit on every play, and in hockey, the big hits, or even the weak hits, just don't actually happen all that often.
That's true, and they're probably a little bit more body to body than head to head. NHL is a lot of leading with their head, which is probably, I mean, that's the thing. Like, I do think the NFL is a game that can, or football is a game that can sustain itself. I don't think it's like there's going to be a death of football in 20 years or something like that from this concussion stuff, but I just think the game does need to change, and they need to start, like, tackling with their arms. Stop leading with your head. Do the players not understand this? I don't get it. Like, it's your brain. Stop doing that to it.
Well, I mean, I guess none of these are new arguments, but that's sort of why you need to start at the lowest level and just work your way up from there.
Yeah, absolutely.
This will.
A week or so ago, I was rewatching the Seahawks 49ers Sunday night game because it's just really fun. And after Cam Chancellor blew the crap out of Vernon Davis on that one play, and he's just on that legal hit, and Vernon Davis gets up, and he's just, you know, wide-eyed and looking around, and he's clearly not right. And it's like, fellow teammates come over and to, like, show camaraderie, like, oh, good job on running the route. I mean, and drawing that penalty, you drop the ball. They're all sitting there, like, slapping him on the head. I'm like, stop it! Guy clearly, you know, just got, like, whiplash at the minimum, and a mild concussion for sure, possibly a major concussion, and you're like, ah, good job, slap, slap, slap. And they do this all the time. Like, Christ, somebody tell them not to do that. Go back to fondling each other's asses or something. It's, you're not going to get ass cancer.
That is baseball jurisdiction. Baseball traffic's more in the ass rabbit. Yeah, the other... This is going to be a football podcast. For me, I think what really sort of got it going, the whole concussion problem is generated this distaste of that field, but what started for me is when I realized that players just get hurt all the time, and it's not necessarily the head injuries. It's just like, oh, well, after every two or three plays, somebody's down.
Oh, yeah, your whole season can just be done, derailed by just because there's an injury on, like, every play.
Yeah. It's hard to watch a sport that's so physically unsustainable.
Right.
It's only getting worse. There's no reason to believe that it's going to stop, because they do just get bigger and stronger and better.
Yeah.
Time. So, long story short, the Mariners have done absolutely fucking nothing, which is why we're talking about this right now, getting up our first podcast in 5 months.
Yeah, well, I have a segue in mind, so I'll have to build to it a little bit.
Well, I do too.
Okay, well, I don't care.
We'll do it. We'll alternate words.
No.
Yes.
No, we're not going to do that.
Dead.
Shut up. I'll just mute you. This podcast will just be my side of the conversation, because I get to post these, not you.
I have the sick voice, and you have the voice that I would bed. And I wouldn't even... Yeah, so like...
God, I wish we had more lady readership.
What is it? Kill, fuck, marry? I mean, are those the three? There's variations on that. Yeah.
Anyways, so...
Fuck your voice. I would fuck your voice.
You're just trying to make me lose my train of thought so you can do your segue.
Yeah, hit it with the segue.
So, a lot of the criticism, sticking with this, with the RG3, the Seahawks and the Redskins game, has been, you know, Mike Shanahan, like, why would you even let Robert Griffin play in that game? The turf was terrible. He had a bulky knee to begin with. All this kind of stuff and second-guessing. And naturally, some of that has also gone on. Like, well, why, you know... RG3's got to be a man and step up, and, you know, there's the stereotypical man who, you know, I'm hurt, I'll play through it, blah, 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 but then there's the people talking about, like, you know, the bigger man would actually recognize when he's hurt and pull himself out of the game because he's hurting his teammate, sort of thing. And while I sympathize with those arguments, I think you'd be dumb to hold your breath for any professional athlete to ever do that. Mm-hmm. And so I never fault the player for that, even though I think the players are stupid for not recognize it. But, I mean, like, and my knowledge of that comes from, I'm a recreational league soccer player. I'm, like, the lowest of the low. And even I play through injuries. Like, I'll have hurt knees, pulled hamstrings. I know. Rationally can stand there and know, like, I should not be playing. I just tweaked my hamstring, and this is bad. I shouldn't be running around. Or I was hobbling on my knee yesterday to the point where it physically pained me to walk up and down even moderate hills, and I was limping. And yet, did I take a game off? No. No, because it's so much ego. And there's, like, you know, I'm not going to pull myself out. Fuck that. I can play through it. And there's an immortality sort of aspect to it of, like, no, this is just, I can do it. And
right, and as you get to the professional level, you can argue different. That, well, you should have a different perspective, because all of a sudden the costs are so, the risks are so substantial, because you have your entire career hinging on this isn't just a recreational, but that would be offset by the dramatically increased stakes of a professional game versus your recreational soccer match.
Right, and there's also the fear of, like, well, if I take a game off from injury, you know, I might get replaced. And in a recreational soccer league, that means nothing. Like, I should have no ego about it, because it doesn't mean anything. To them, that could mean millions and millions of dollars. Alex Smith was leading a division and conference-leading football team. He gets a minor injury, sits out, he lost his job. And I don't, who knows if he's ever going to be a starting quarterback. That might have cost him millions of dollars. That's always going to be probably in the back of any professional athlete's head. Plus, professional athletes are going to have even bigger egos, even bigger God complexes than me. So, you know, it's really got to come down to the coaches there. And here's my segue. What this reminded me of was Raul Ibanez, 2007, playing for months with what later turned out to be an injury because he didn't want to take himself out of the lineup because probably he was worried about Adam Jones. And the manager's just letting it slide. And great, hey, guess what we have? Raul Ibanez back again.
Well, you know, the problem is you're absolutely right. The players are always going to want to stay on the field, and it absolutely has to fall to the coaches and the team. And the misstep that the team makes is they ask the players.
Yeah.
And they trust the players. Like, oh,
right.
Felix has your arm. Good? Keep pitching.
Yeah.
And then that's where it ends. And not that you can necessarily lean on this objective data because there's not always indicators of when there's an injury, but you know, another time you have a quarterback who's limping to the sideline on a bootleg, and then it's like, well, you don't really, you don't normally do that with a healthy knee.
Yeah, or over sailing passes because you can't plant on it and sort of thing. You know, I'd hope that the actually good pitching coaches aren't people who would go out to the mound and be like, how's your arm feeling? And they just take that at face value. I'd hope they're looking for things like arm slot and, you know, mannerisms in between pitches and can, you know, have just the years and years of experience to deduce based on, you know, those kind of like more subtle clues how the pitcher's feeling and then just use that as a, I don't know, a way, I think as a pitching coach, you probably would always ask him to say that because you'd want him to have his say in it or feel like the pitcher had his say in it and then you override him.
Right. And I wonder if teams have people paying attention to, I guess it would be pitch effects, basically, or if pitcher injuries are infrequent enough that it's not worth having somebody designated just basically be objectively looking at the arm slots or the velocity trends, et cetera. Because you have a radar gun, you have visual cues, so maybe it's not necessary, but something I nearly wrote about and then didn't because whatever. it was going to be a pull, and it was sort of inspired also by the RG3 thing. Not to take this away from your Raul Ibanez point that we can get back to later, but so Mariners, one game playoff, and of course Felix is starting it, and I don't know, second inning, Felix throws a fastball and comes in at 88, and the coach goes out and he asks Felix, "What's up?" And Felix says he's fine, and you're a fan, what do you want the Mariners to do if and I don't know, then Felix throws some warm up pitches and maybe they're all 88, 90. I don't know. There's no exact parallel that I've made with this yet. It's clearly I didn't write about it.
Yeah.
But what do you do, just given those conditions?
Yeah. That's worth exploring, fleshing out into a good solid question. I assume from my head you'd probably want to frame it as it's like the wild card play-in game in order to make it more analogous because there are. I mean, if it's like Game 7 of the World Series, you know, that changes the stakes.
Right.
And also makes it like, oh, there's no future games on this, but the, you know, the wild card is like, well, we need to win this to get in, but we also need many more wins after this to make it anything meaningful.
Absolutely.
And I wouldn't, 88 would still seem too high. I wouldn't, like, even just me, I wouldn't be concerned if Felix started throwing 88 for a couple pitches, because it's just, whatever. I don't trust radar guns to be that precise, and Felix might just be doing the thing. But if it was like 86, then I'd be like, what the fuck was that?
Yeah. So,
that's the level I started getting bored.
Dropped arm angle, just something.
Yeah. And, or shakes his arm after each, like, after a pitch or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, he's like coughing out blood. How are you
open,
doing?
They're open sores. Oh, damn it, he got tuberculosis. Why does this keep happening to us? And as a reminder again that the Mariners had a player with tuberculosis and he played with it for months. People die from it.
On the best team ever.
People die. People generally can't function at all. And this was a major league player playing every day on the best team in baseball.
I remember reading an article that went over some of the background and he would wake up regularly, during the season, wake up and just go to the bathroom and cough up blood.
Yeah.
And feel ill. And he was just told the whole time, no, don't worry about it.
I guess that's the part I was confused. Did he actively seek out, like, a diagnosis at some point and was told, like, it's nothing? Or did he just keep that to himself for months?
I think, I'm going to have to reread, but I think that he had told a few veterans on the team.
Yeah.
But I think he was somebody must have said something that it's not that big of a deal early on, then they kind of stuck with it. And I think it came to a head and things got worse. And then somebody's like, oh, by the way, you have this potentially lethal illness and you've had it for months.
Yeah. That would be actually a really good retrospective. Somebody could dig through and try and find out what actually transpired in terms of, like, who we talked to, what were their responses. I mean, it'd probably be impossible to get, like, a really truthful version, but...
Well, I'm taking notes right now.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe some of the beat reporters, maybe, like, Shannon remembers who we talked to at the time or whatever. Or maybe Carlos Keene's willing to talk now. He's not doing anything else. Not getting a baseball job.
We might still have tuberculosis.
Yeah. We can talk over the phone, right? I mean, other than the fact that I seem to be catching your cold over this Skype call, I don't think things are usually transmittable.
Well, I mean, we identified that he had it, but I don't recall ever reading that he was cured.
Oh, right. We got halfway there and then forgot to do the other thing.
Yeah, probably shouldn't have signed up to that minor league contract knowing that you forgot to cure his tuberculosis.
Maybe that's why they cut him all of a sudden. They're like, oh, shit. We forgot.
Are we accomplices? I'm thinking of that Felix thing, and I think I will turn that into a post tomorrow or today or whatever. Fuck it. We do this every time. I know that just as a fan, there's that psychological boost of being like, oh, it's Felix instead of... Actually, I guess the Mariners bullpen is awesome right now. But, you know, I don't know anything about Kirk Cousins, the backup in RG3.
Yeah.
But if Eric Wedge went out there and he's like, hey, Felix, how's your arm? Felix is fine. And then you leave Felix in the wild card playoff, you want to argue that there's some sort of adrenaline there and that you feel stronger, that maybe the Mariners feel better knowing that their ace is out there, but... realistically, you can think of it this way. Felix is, I don't know, let's maybe even exaggerate and say he's 25% better than any other reliever on the roster or something. Then you can say, well, then how much worse? Because if Felix is not 100%, which he wouldn't be with a lower arm angle and reduced velocity and coughing up blood, then by how many percentage points now do you have to drag him down?
Yeah, and what does that translate over to? You know, over the course of what's basically going to be like 8 innings of work, like,
right.
It really comes down to like nothing. Especially because relievers generally are better than starting pitchers since they can go shorter stints, and we could just be like, well, we're just going to burn through the bullpen.
Yeah, and then in a wild card playoff, you presume nearly full availability.
Yeah,
wasn't there some sort of rule this year that you could have to set a separate roster for the wild card playoff?
Yeah, you're asking the wrong person.
I recall reading that, which is absurd, because then you can just load the team up with 11 relievers and a starter, or whatever.
Yeah, it's true. I think maybe, I mean, I hope not. That would be dumb. You should have to set it for the wildcard playoff and the divisional round.
Right, yeah, no, I agree. Anyway, yeah. I think
there's also the thing that, like, you know, emotions in baseball don't really mean anything. You can't will yourself to being a better hitter.
Yeah.
Or pitching, or really, you can't really will yourself to pitching faster either. It's putting more curve on a curveball. Like, that stuff can kind of work in hockey and can kind of work in football because effort means something, but effort in a baseball game isn't really, it doesn't translate really into anything. You maybe running the bases, but, you know, it's not much.
If you try to, you know what happens if you try to effort more curve on your curveball is that you tear your elbow like your
finger. Yeah, or you bounce it, or you sail it. Like, you rarely just get a more better curveball, which is something I just invented.
Yeah, no, the emotion thing is true, and either that you can't will yourself to be better, or you can, and today's players are just really indifferent.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that stuff, like, that's realistically what you, where you will yourself to be better is by training more. You know, that's the, that's where the, and maybe that's what Raul Abanez brings, is that he certainly is a workout fiend, although we saw how that worked with Unieski Betancourt for that day.
What was that?
I don't know, but I remember it was, that's right, right? That Betancourt was going to spend the, one of those off seasons with Abanez, and it lasted 2 days or something.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know this anecdote, and I don't know if this is public knowledge or not, but it is now.
Whoops.
Raul Abanez is crazy workout, I think in Miami or somewhere in Florida. Anyway, one off season, when they were both Mariners, Abanez invited Betancourt down to train with him, which was a good veteran move. And you think, okay, well, maybe that's sort of one of the reasons that the Mariners re-signed him now, so he can do that kind of thing. Well, the effect that he had is that Betancourt worked out for a day, and then did not. And that's it. Because, so it kind of turns out that you can't sign a guy to make other guys better. They will be as good as their talent and their drive allows them to be. And in theory, Ibanez could say a certain combination of words that, like, inspires, I don't know, Dustin Ackley, if he can even hear. But more
Wait,
likely,
you're surmising that Dustin Ackley is deaf?
I'm surmising that there might be something wrong with Dustin Ackley's five senses. Something in the post that may not be published yet. So we'll see. This is all off-season science. But, yeah, that, all, there's so many angles to the Ibanez signing that I want to explore just for, like, basically almost psychological or philosophical reasons, where there's no proof, there's no evidence to talk about anything, just all the various arguments in favor and then against bringing him in, because there's a whole lot you can say about realistically basically no effect, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, you pretty much have to leave the realm of testable hypotheses, science, etc., and just go into it's a philosophical debate. Like, you're just going to exchange rhetoric points and see you can make interesting arguments. And see if that changes, you know, or, you know, brings up anything that's worth considering. But it's, there's not going to be anything you can test.
Right, and that's sort of what one of the things I was trying to get to with that poll where I was a. You know, I compared Raul Ibanez and Mike Karp, and they're basically the same idea of a player. And Ibanez is going to cost money, and Karp is going to go away. And so even though I asked that poll where it's like, well, do you trust the Mariners that Ibanez is worth this much more than Mike Karp, given that they're basically the same kind of player?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no right or wrong answer, for God's sake, but I was just curious to see what people think. But it's that kind of question that is interesting to me, because, I mean, do the Mariners really know if Ibanez is worth $2 million more than Mike Karp? Of course they don't, but they are damn certain, otherwise they wouldn't have made this investment. So,
I don't know. I actually, I'm curious if even they think it's true, or judging by, so on my Twitter, I keep a safe search with just using the Mariners hashtag.
That's a good idea.
It's a terrible idea, but it has some use for when I miss news, and most of my feed is dominated by non-Mariner sources, so if something happens, I might miss, especially in the morning or whatever, because the Mariners like to make their moves at completely inconvenient hours.
Yeah, fuck you. God.
You know what would be awesome? If we just had somebody in the front office who would tip us off. Like, I don't even want... I'm not going to leak. I don't care about breaking stories. I don't. I just want to know, like, a heads up that, hey, we're going to do something in an hour or two, so I can be like, okay, thanks. At least so I know. I don't need to even know what you're doing.
Your uncertainty kills me inside. You're taking days off my life. But
oh, so what are you, the U.S. economy now?
You trade Michael Chan for Jesus Montero on a Friday afternoon in January? Fuck you. I was going to a bar. It was 5 o'clock. Big trade swirls with Mariners and Yankees. All right, it's only the most hyped prospect in baseball. No big deal. Or you sign Raul Ibanez on a fucking Saturday before Christmas, which, granted, Raul Ibanez is not the same kind of profile. But there was the Andre Ethier rumor that also not in the Mariners' control, but that comes out New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
8 at night. I mean, this is stupid bullshit. Take time off.
Well, now they're taking way too much time off.
Oh, yeah. Take time off when other people take time off and work. during 9 to 5.
Yeah, Monday through Thursday. Maybe stop at 2 on Fridays.
Yeah, that'll be super.
Yeah. Do your work so like my work is easy.
Oh, also, I have Fangraphs weekly conference calls, so don't do anything during that.
Anyways, what was I going to say? Something about, oh, yeah, the Twitter feed. It does give me, I think, a decent gauge on, like, the level of non-lookout landing commenter fandom of the Mariners and how they're reacting to things. Mm-hmm. I think the Raul Ibanez thing was pretty mixed to panned on lookout landing, which rightfully so, because analytically there's no justification for it. You have to totally go with the intangibles. Based on the Twitter's and, you know, like, Facebook response to it, everybody fucking loves Raul Ibanez and the fact that he comes back. So I'm just wondering at some point, are the Mariners looking at all the big-name free agents going elsewhere or not telling the Mariners, being like, we're not signing with you. I don't care how much money you give me. And the whole kind of start of the offseason and then the stories about the payroll and the payroll needing to go up and payroll being allowed to go up. Are they sitting there and starting to wonder, like, shit, we need to spend money on somebody? Because, we cannot. I don't think. They might think, and it might be justified, that they really cannot afford to go into the 2013 season with, like, a $70 million payroll. And certainly not after the Seahawks have, like, reminded everybody that, like, hey, the playoffs are fun.
It's definitely been on my mind where the Mariners talk this huge game about spending more money up to and exceeding $91 million. And then, I mean, people need to accept that money. Otherwise, you can't spend that money. And it becomes this problem where they still have time to spend that money, but it's this PR game where if you don't, then you look the fool. And yeah. You don't want to end up in a situation where you're spending just because you said you would spend, because then that'd be irresponsible. But that was another thing that I have not written about yet, because it turns out I don't care. But if the Mariners...
It's hard to get excited when they just don't do anything.
Yeah. I mean, if the Mariners said if they budgeted for $91 million, let's say they went in with a $70 million payroll for whatever, what happens then to the money that would have been earmarked for Josh Hamilton? Do they... Like, it never rolls over, but in this case, would it roll over? Will they then have a massive payroll potentially going forward, or what? And we can't know.
Yeah, and I don't think it really makes sense, because it's hard to then be like, oh, well, we had $25 million to spend last winter, and we didn't spend it, so now we have $50 million to spend this winter. Well, if you could sign everybody to just one-year contracts, it might be able to work that way, but it doesn't work that way. So... Whatever, I don't know. Give it to Felix, I don't care.
Yeah, actually, just put him in charge.
Yeah.
Just give him all of the money.
Although, kind of on that note, and maybe possibly related to that, and we'll call this the last topic for this podcast, is the Justin Upton rumors.
Yeah, another place to potentially spend some money.
Yeah, if they... And I guess it was the same thing with Andre Ethier, much more so with Ethier, because Ethier is clearly not worth his future contract. And that was kind of my fear. That was just like, oh, but if they could bring in Ethier, he's somebody who can be described as a big bat. And they'd be like, look, see, we spent money bringing in this guy. Kind of getting themselves covering their own ass. When it comes to Justin Upton, Upton's a better player, signed for a lot less years. Separate from the question of what Arizona would want from the Mariners, what would you be willing to give up, roughly, for Justin Upton?
So I think I've expressed in the past that I'm pretty comfortable with the idea of moving, like, any of the pitching prospects, because they're pitching prospects, they're prospects, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to let a pitching prospect in AA stand in the way of getting a potential awesome, but realistically just good outfielder. So I would, you know, I would gauge whatever Arizona's interest is in Franklin, because, I mean, I'm content to move Franklin. I'm content to move all of them. Obviously, I would try to keep Walker, but I wouldn't even draw the line at Walker to get Upton. I would be extraordinarily uncomfortable dealing with Zunino. I don't know how much of that is hype, but I have, like, no interest in moving Mike Zunino at all. but I think I would start with Hilton, maybe try to build around Hilton, and then if Arizona was like, that's not enough, then I would start with Walker, and it would be hard, but from there, then I would throw in another guy, maybe a Franklin, and Z, because I feel like it's obviously a risk, but it's a risk both ways, and I'm not going to allow myself to be too worried about trading a pitching prospect who's only succeeded somewhat in Double A, which all of them have.
Right. Well, I guess what I'm more interested in, where would you, if you were the Mariners, at what point do you walk away? Like, you know, if, or like, what would be the maximum that you'd be willing to trade for Upton if Arizona came back and said, you know, we want Holtzen, Paxton, Franklin, and Carter Capps?
I don't like that very much. I can say that. I'm not good at trade proposals because I can't do. I'm not real good with prospect valuations in my head because I have.
I'm asking emotionally. I'm not asking you to sit down and sketch out. Oh, well, these people are worth that. I'm just saying, like, if that deal came across Twitter, what's your best gauge on how you would react? Do you think like sweet or oh, that's a lot to give up? Or
I would. I think that my initial reaction would be, "Holy shit! I better write about this."
Yeah.
It would be like, it was. You said, Holton, Paxton, Franklin, Capps.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
I think that my main reaction would be, "Well, this is really exciting, but that sure seems like it's a pretty steep overpay." I think I would like to keep it to two young players of significance. And, you know, beyond that, whatever, rolls of the dice. But Carter Capps is already on the big league roster. I think he's going to be – he has the potential to be the team's best reliever next year.
Mm-hmm.
6 years of team control, I would sooner move Pryor, obviously. But, yeah, if it was like Holton, Paxton, Capps, or Holton, Franklin, Capps, then that changes things, which goes without – saying. But I think off the top of my head, two good prospects and then a third piece that is, you know, of interest but not of significant interest.
Okay.
I wonder if they would go for something like Paxton, Franklin, Pryor. I highly doubt it, especially if they've been insisting on like Elvis Andrews and Jerickson Profar all this time. That seems exorbitant.
Yeah. I'm working on a post looking at it just for my own benefit. It started out, and right now it's currently a mess of like four different drafts jumbled together, but my sense is, especially now that I have a handle on it, what I think Arizona wants and what they could probably hold out to get if they're going to trade Justin Upton is far in excess of what I want to see the Mariners give up.
Mm-hmm.
I think Upton's been a little underrated by the whole, like, oh, road splits and look how bad he is, and obviously Dave wrote about that. But at the same time, I think, and this tends to be a systemic overlook, is while he's not exorbitantly paid, he's not cost-controlled really either. He's going to get paid an average of $13 million a year for the next 3 years. And he's going to be worth more than that, but what really matters, well, part of what matters is how much more worth. That's what you're trading for, is that value between what he's getting paid and what he produces.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to kind of think about, well, is that gap there, how much is that worth? And also, obviously, like, what would he replace? You know, there's the value to the wins themselves, but it's not like you could say, you know, like, oh, Justin Upton's like, you know, projecting to be like a 4-win player. It's like, right, but he's also getting paid as a 2.5-win player.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you really netting?
Yeah.
And therefore, what are you willing to give up to get that?
And the trick with Justin Upton is that it's not like, I'll throw Prince Fielder or something out there. It's not like you're trading for a guy that you know is, or that you have a high degree of confidence in being a superstar, where, I mean, Justin Upton just last year was like a 2.5 win player.
Yeah.
Just last year. And the year before that, MVP candidate, whatever year before that, he was just a little above average again. So it's this whole, if you think about how difficult it is for fans to trade their prospects because they get so up on evaluating them by their ceilings. Well, if you're Arizona, you look at Justin Upton, you think you have a young MVP candidate under 3 years of team control left.
Yeah.
They move, and other teams are going to be like, well, you're right. He's very talented, but except for all this other stuff. And that's why it's really hard for me to see Arizona actually trading him at this point. I think they'll just end up doing the boring thing and trading Cool to, I don't know, like the garbage.
Yeah, gosh, I really hope the Mariners do not get involved in that, because I don't see what Jason Kubel gives the Mariners at all.
A salary?
Yeah, I guess.
So it's really hard for me to see how Upton gets dealt unless the Diamondbacks convince the team that he is
a 5-win player.
Yeah, a better bet to be great.
Yeah.
The numbers suggest. And, I mean, he had, like, a really good final month last year. He had, like, an injury he was playing through, like, always. But everybody has an excuse. So, and the whole Arizona ballpark thing is a factor. It makes me nervous, but I'm also at the point where if the Mariners overpaid for Justin Upton, I'd be like, well, I mean, that was an overpay, but at least we have this guy. And it's important to just be entertained. So...
I'm always more skittish about an overpaying in trades than I am an overpaying in free agency. As much as, I mean, free agency obviously gets the bigger headlines because there's just more free agent signings than big trades. But when it comes right down to it, you overpay in free agency. You know, Sean Figgins, for example, so some money's gone. It's hard to have that counterfactual with a free agent signing. Like, oh, well, if we hadn't signed him, we could have, well, what? Yeah, the team would have not spent that money on him, and maybe they could have signed somebody else, but you can't even guarantee that, oh, well, they could have spent this money on and signed this guy, because you never know. Maybe that guy was like, no, I do not want to play for the Mariners. But with a trade, there's always that counterfactual of, well, we could have hung on to this player and this player and this player and this player. You can go back to the Bedard trade and said, well, the Mariners could have had George Sherrill, Adam Jones, Cam Micolio, Tony Butler, and Chris Tillman. Like, there was no... There's a readily available, if they hadn't done that, this is what, you know, likely would have happened sort of scenario. So I feel like there's a much bigger risk, in, just emotionally, of like, oh, you trade a guy, you trade a prospect, and he blossoms, and you're like, fuck. You sign a guy to too much money and he tanks, you're like, that sucks. And you generally just end up hating him. But it's I don't think it's quite as deep.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
And, I mean, if you want to be cold about it, you can say, well, what are prospect but values and what is anything? It all just comes down to the values.
Yeah, numbers, but on a stretch. But yeah, but that's not how we emotionally process things.
No, I mean, if you trade Adam Jones and he becomes a good player, well, you think, well, you can't just like bench a guy and play somebody else because you have a free agent disappointment. It's just like, well, we had that guy, now we have to go find a center fielder because we don't have Adam Jones. So, yep. Emotionally, I am much better dealing with a financial overpay than a prospect overpay. I think we have established that we do not deal well with prospect overpays emotionally. Those are difficult times.
Well, I mean, to be fair, our really one case of that was such an egregious, nonsensical overpay that I don't think it really... I mean, it throws off the curve. We really should try to do our best to distance ourselves from that.
Yeah.
And also buy in a really incompetent GM, so... I don't know, I just don't... The degree to which people, even for Stanton, the degree to which people were like, I would trade Paxton, Holtzman, Walker, Franklin, and like Michael Saunders for Mike Stanton, was like, I'm sitting there, and I'm like, oh no. Stanton's awesome, but you are gutting the farm system for this guy. And I'm not saying that's stupid or even wrong, but I just, and it's kind of one of those, before I put on my analytic hat, and I read that, and I'm like, oh, that makes me very worried, sort of feeling.
Yeah, Stan's already got knee problems.
Yeah, and it's more like he strikes out a lot already, sure. And yeah, and he's an NL player, and it's like, there's, yeah, he's great. He's an amazingly great player. He might be one of the strongest hitters in baseball, but it's not like he doesn't have any red flags. And so trading, you know, everybody in your farm system but Mike Zunino is like, yeah, I don't know.
And the Mariners are not at the point where the upgrade from a Saunders to a Stanton is like, well, you're champions now.
Yeah, right, exactly. So I don't, it's a lesser version of that with Upton. I mean, sitting there and like, even I'm not even sure if it was Paxton and Franklin, I'm not even sure I'm happy. Emotionally, I'm happy because it's like, all right, but also that could be a pretty interesting if Goody was actually healthy and you have like a Saunders Goody Upton outfield. Like, holy crap, that's really defensively good.
Yeah, but you're forgetting about the Bay Ibanez.
Yeah, well, exactly. We do also still have, like, Eric Thames, Jason Bay, and Raul Ibanez in our outfield for some reason.
That's for Wells.
You know, he's never going to play.
He's fine, but he's, yeah, you know.
Yeah, no, we love him, but he's never going to play. Oh, well.
Yeah.
So we'll call that an end for this time.
And we'll do so by letting you know that we're calling it the end.
And, yes.
Next time, we'll probably go for a little longer because we will not record this at 11 at night. And maybe next time we'll have something to talk about if there is a next time.
Right. Who knows? We keep trying, but we keep failing. But then we keep trying again. These are like heroin.
Yeah, you should see my arms. I think maybe that's why we got sick, because we kept injecting, sharing needles.
Yes.
And then we podcasted.
It's amazing that we've been able to stay awake for 45 minutes to record this. That's what happens with heroin, right? Like, you fall asleep.
I'm going to go look at constellations in my bathtub.
Okay. I'm going to just go to bed. So, and you out there in the listening world, no matter what time of the day it is, you should also go to bed, because sleep's important and you don't get enough of it.
That's true. In this hectic, herky-jerky, something-something, how long you guys? I don't know. I don't know where this is going.
All right. Signing off.
Bye.
Bye.